In the middle of the second century, there was a church leader. His name was Polycarp. And legend has it, or the early church father, some of the historians have it, that Polycarp actually was discipled directly by the author of Revelation, John, the Apostle John. And Polycarp actually served as the bishop, the overseer of the church in a city called Smyrna, a very city that we're going to look at the letter today. And Polycarp has a fairly famous story about his martyrdom, about his death. As Polycarp had gotten older in age, and one night he had a dream. And he had a dream that he was going to die ultimately by fire. And soon he would find out that there was a persecution of the church that was happening, and people were being falsely accused, and Polycarp was willing to offer himself as opposed to others within the church, and was willing to be stand in for what they were being accused of. And Polycarp was taken into a large stadium and asked to pledge allegiance to Caesar, to bend the knee to the fact that Caesar was Lord, and Polycarp refused. And at his refusal, he actually said this: 86 years I have served him, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my king and savior now? And he would go on to say, and I'll update this into more modern English: I bless you, Father, for judging me worthy of this hour, so that in the company of the martyrs, I may share the cup of Christ. And soon after, they tried, this is where legend gets a little more interesting, to try to burn him, but somehow the fire did not ultimately hurt him in any ways. And eventually they had to stab him, and ultimately his blood helped put out the fire at his death. Though I wonder, in this incredible story of the martyrdom of Polycarp, At the moment of leading up to his death, one of the things that was sustaining him, in addition to the Holy Spirit, his enabling to face this death with courage and peace and freedom from fear, were the very words that Jesus speaks through the letter to the church in Revelation. A letter that would have been written to the very city that Polycarp is bishop of. And as we work through each of these seven letters, it's important sometimes to remember that they all fit into a larger vision. A larger vision in a whole letter that begins with the description of Jesus Christ in all of his post-resurrection sort of glory. Right from the get-go, it is the Jesus who is almighty, the Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last, the one who was dead but is now alive forevermore, Jesus who holds the hands of death and Hades. It is Jesus who walks amongst his churches. He knows the exact circumstances of each of his churches and the congregations, what they're facing. He starts each letter saying, I know these things about you. He knows their troubles and the nature of the evil that they are confronting, and all the ways sort of that the pagan culture around them is working against them. And Jesus commends these churches for their faith and perseverance, confronts them for the sin. And this is sort of the setup. We have to, I think most weeks, kind of step back and remember sort of what these people would have heard and listened to there. That chapter one would have unpacked the beauty of the one who is speaking these words. But let's look, as we will each of these weeks, also at the context of the city that we are stepping into here. And the city this week is Smyrna. Not Smyrna, Georgia, but Smyrna, located in western Turkey. Smyrna, a city named after myrrh, as most people think, is a spice that's regularly used for various things, but one of the most common uses, and we certainly see this at the death of Jesus, is in burial, in death. This was also a city that has a higher concentration of ancient writings that with a fascination with death and even Roman myths as well about death. Smyrna, on the map, you sort of have a few coastal cities amongst the seven cities that these letters are written to. And the best way to think about Smyrna is maybe sort of the Boston of Western Turkey. And what I mean by that is they were always a little bit overshadowed by Ephesus. Ephesus had greater commerce. Ephesus had more connection to government, more connection to wealth and finances, more attention overall with the Temple of Artemis. And just like Boston and New York City, New York City is the large metropolitan, and Boston's sort of slightly there, always trying to keep up, and sometimes having some rivalry with the reputation of the city. And so Smyrna is sort of the second place, but always wanting to be first place in terms of the overall metropolitan feel. But it was also a city that was destroyed in 600 BC, really almost decimated. Historians actually almost write about it as if it ceased to exist. So it was almost like it was dead. And then you had Alexander the Great come along, conquer all over the Mediterranean. And one of the things, he has this dream that a city should be rebuilt right where Smyrna stood, as if the city was brought back to life. The city actually thought of itself as a city that had died and been resurrected. They were proud citizens, just like Bostonians. They called themselves the first in Asia. They even have, and here's a sort of an artist rendering of the mountainside around the city. But the mountainside would have been dotted with a few, not only the Acropolis, which is sort of like the governmental city center, but a few temples that had been built. And it almost looked like a crown. And they were referred to themselves and others around it, referred to them as the crown of Asia. They were extremely faithful to Rome, more than any of the other seven cities. They built even a temple to the goddess Roma and dedicated themselves to so much of the Roman system, and even had Roman class structures that would have distinguished themselves by things like crowns as well. And one more thing that they were known for was the Jewish congregants that did exist in the city, that there was some portion of them that did not seem to accept the Gentiles into their worship. Now, that's really problematic for multiple reasons. There are established religions within Rome, but the Jews were always given, back to Augustine's day, Jews were given an exception around pledging allegiance to Caesar. The Jews were always allowed by law to not necessarily bend the knee and were allowed to kind of worship freely in a lot of ways. Now, as you have Jews that are converting into Christianity, but you also have Gentiles converting into Christianity, and at this time probably still worshiping in synagogues and trying to figure out what this new offshoot of Judaism kind of looks like, there was always a discussion of what do we do with these Gentiles? And there seemed to be some controversy, and we could certainly see that through the writings of Paul. But what is likely the case that happened here is these Christians were not, or these Gentile believers, these new Christians were not allowed to worship and not fall under the protection of the Jewish umbrella, saying we don't have to pledge allegiance to Caesar. And so these Christians are now no longer under the protection of that, and now can be killed or persecuted for not pledging allegiance. And so Jews showing no hospitality to these Gentile converts. So now, with all that in mind, let's imagine you're in Smyrna. At some point you hear that you've received this letter from John down in Ephesus, and you have to imagine maybe the attendance on Sunday picking up a bit. Word's gotten around that this letter has arrived and it's about to be read, that John has heard from Christ himself and has spoke to this apostle when he was exiled to Patmos, and actually has a letter for your city to hear what Christ has said to your city. And it's opened and they read this. Verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write the words of the first and the last, we've talked about before, quoting Isaiah 44, who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, will not be hurt by the second death. And so I think this letter ultimately, a letter that doesn't include a critique like we saw last week in Ephesus, but an encouragement and a steadfastness, and ultimately this idea of a call to faithfulness. And it's a call to faithfulness in light of, I think, four areas that we already see of sort of persecution and suffering. And the first we see in verse 9 in poverty. It says, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. Now remember, this town is incredibly loyal to Rome and to the Caesars. They even built the temple to Tiberius maybe half a decade before they won out the opportunity to build this temple to one of the Caesars. And they were intensely proud and patriotic citizens, and likely resented these Christians who had come along, and instead of offering incense to Caesar, they refused. They refused to participate in this new cult of emperor worship that would have existed in the city. It would have been idolatry to them. A Christian cannot call Caesar Lord while also calling Jesus Christ Lord. And these pagans in the city and their neighbors likely interpreted this refusal almost like treason. If they're not willing to bow their knee, then these Christians in the city would have really struggled with commerce and relationships and everything else. Now imagine, like, you're a Christian businessman or woman, like, your shop would likely be boycotted, your goods would be shunned, you would eventually struggle to make profit, to do anything. And this is the case. This is sort of likely the poverty that is spoken of here. And I think this still can hold true today. And Christians say, I think our culture is increasingly compelling us to sort of sacrifice to the culture's idols. And say, well, this is just the cost of living in a pluralistic society. But what they're not doing is compromising. And they're willing to be poor for the sake of not compromising. They're receiving scorn and the world, and they should be commended for courage and faithfulness. And Their lives are threatened, their livelihoods are being threatened, and yet they're being faithful. And I think at times there's some pressure on us to participate in the larger chaos that is the world we live in. And I think the words here would push us in a different direction. That it's better to be a spiritually rich poor person than a spiritually poor rich person. That the commendation here is that these people, yes, they're experiencing certainly physical poverty, but their richness is what really matters. And what's really so valuable, it wasn't money and material things. Jesus encourages them to endure this injustice. He reminds them that they are rich, richer than celebrities and athletes and programmers and people who live on beachfronts, whatever it is, because they have Jesus. Someone else might have a greater car, more money in bank account, nicer homes, all the things that become the hustle and bustle, the things we try to keep up with, that keep us discontent and all those kind of things. But if you have Jesus, you are richer than anything else that you could sort of go after. And I'm not sure we really believe that. It is one of the greatest idols of our culture to sort of always look for the next best thing to buy, look for the more square footage, look for the better vacations, whatever it may be, and yet not be content. None of those things are evil in and of themselves, but if we're not content at the same time, then we sin. And sometimes we miss out on that. And in the midst of suffering, particularly, that they might be extremely wealthy spiritually. 1 Peter 1 says this, in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, these people who are suffering. So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And we'll see this in Paul and others too, that they write about just the preciousness of being willing to suffer, and that in that there's actually richness. It helps complete us, train us, make us more fully developed, well-rounded, mature, and well-equipped Christians who are stable and strong, and makes us like Jesus. And there's nothing more valuable than that. So they experience poverty. They also experience slander. We actually find out it's not just the zealous Romans, but the slanderous Jews in the city that are causing these problems, which is fascinating. You go back to the story of Polycarp. You actually find the Romans and the Jews work together to bring about the death of Polycarp. But it says this, in the slander of those who say that they are Jews and they are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. So as I said, there's a group saying, we are the real Jews. These Gentiles are not a part of us. And so leaving them ultimately out to be persecuted. And John here is saying, these people who say they're the real Jews are not the real Jews at all. The very essence of being a Jew is being a light to the Gentiles. And these people are shutting them out. And even more so, John points out that they're doing the tools. They're doing the work of the devil himself. And once again, this might be another way that we still, in our day, experience some similar suffering. There's definitely a rise in the mocking and misrepresentation of our beliefs. Whether it's labeled as homophobia, whether it's labeled as hatred, whether it's dismissive that we're uneducated or antiquated, whatever it may be, there's ways that sort of the slander, the accusations and stuff like that certainly are growing and growing as we seek to be faithful to what Jesus has said and revealed about what is true. And so in the face of that slander, what do we do? And I think we'll get there. But they also face imprisonment. Verse 10, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison. Now, a reminder, these prisons in ancient days are merely brief holdovers. There's no long, drawn-out trials. There's nothing like that. You're held there until you find out pretty quickly whether you're going to be fined for your whatever happened, whether you're going to be in exile like John experienced, or whether you're going to be killed for it. There's just not the same legal processes. And at that time, it's interesting, the same time where it is wicked leaders, whatever the Jews or the Romans who are opposing them, Jesus reminds them that they're actually engaged in a spiritual battle. We're sort of given this pullback of the curtain that says, no, it is the devil who is going to throw you into prison. Behind the curtain, Satan is the one who is actually at work. You have a spiritual adversary, not just a political, not just a physical people on the ground. You have a spiritual adversary working against you. And then he warns them about death, that they're called to be faithful unto death, that they would experience poverty, slander, imprisonment, and an imprisonment that might lead to their death. Which, as I said, we saw in the story of Polycarp. And death for their faith was a real possibility facing them in Smyrna. Now, most of us aren't in this category. Not like people, Christians trying to be faithful in places like Afghanistan and others. But you and I still have problems in our lives, serious problems, heartbreaking difficulties. And some of those related to just being obedient or trying to be obedient in our faith. And some of us don't. Let me just say here, there were Christians who were entangled into the deepest and most desperate of human trials, the valley of the shadow of death, and just missing just how tested these people were compared to us. But God consoles them with a consolation that could still be yours, even in lighter trials, even in lighter ways that we seek to be obedient and might cause us to experience harder moments. And if your heart's burdened, like if you feel weighed down, grievous because there's trials by God, you are trying to be faithful, you're trying to work through those things, you're trying to be faithful and glorify God, even in the midst of your suffering, whatever it may be, know well the consolation that God gives these Christians in Smyrna, saying, do not fear, endure. There'll be provision. Ultimately, God won't give us ultimately more than we can handle without his Spirit with us. But the temptation might be there. And I think there's a little bit of a hint of that in the midst of this. He says, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Now, their faithfulness is both a cause for their suffering, but also the response that's desired in their suffering. That's faithfulness tested. the test of whether people will compromise or not. And luckily, it sounds like Smyrna are people that remained faithful. But what the text sort of hints at is this in the midst of suffering, in the midst of hard times, in the midst of being obedient and all that might be involved in that, it may get really hard. And will you be faithful? If the weather changes, are you prepared to be faithful when your faithfulness might bring suffering? And we're mentioned 10 days, and maybe that's standard legal code. It's hard to sort of find the history on that. And maybe this is even a callback to Daniel 1, this idea of 10 days. They too, in Daniel 1, you have this push for idolatry for Daniel and his friends. And ultimately they say, hold on, like we want 10 days of testing. The pressure on them to compromise their faithfulness to God. And they say, no, hold on. We don't want to eat from the food dedicated to idols. We don't want to sit at the king's table. We don't want this sort of idolatry. Especially when the king's considered divine, especially when the food is idolatrous. And they say, look, test us. May we come through on the other side. And the good of that, and sort of maybe even the usage of this idea of 10 days, is that it does point that to the fact that suffering, at least for these people in Smyrna, is certain, yes, but also possibly limited. And because suffering is certain, we shouldn't be surprised, but because suffering is limited, we shouldn't despair. And their suffering may be limited because maybe things will get easier. Maybe circumstances will work out. Maybe there's ways that the people in town do change, and eventually they will over time. But maybe the limitedness is the day after or the moment Polycarp's physical body gives way. And that suffering is done. And he gets to stand in the presence of the creator of the universe who has died for his sins to redeem his soul and experience eternity with him where there's no more weeping and no more suffering. I think sometimes we're always hoping for the kingdom to come in its fullness right now. But the call to God's people is to be faithful in the good and the bad, to be enduring to the finish line, whatever the final lap may look like. It may be a peaceful end at 85, 90 years old in your bed, and maybe being persecuted for your very faith and burned at the stake. Either way, endure until the end. Because there's victory. And I think that's where the letter gets at the end too. To be faithful, that martyrdom, though apparent defeat in the eyes of the world, is supreme victory from the perspective of God, from the one who has faith. He even says, look, in death, I will give you the crown of life. And to these people in the city that was known as the crown, and was very Roman, so crowns were so tied into this. People who would know crown as their identity and their status in this whole system. God's saying here, no, in your death, it is not defeat, it is victory. And it is not Rome who gives you your identity and crown, it is Jesus who does this. And last week, it was about the cross of life, the tree of life. And now John is drawing again on sort of this idea. It says, no, your identity, your reward, it is the crown of life and is given by Christ. And what looks like defeat is victory. It is upside down, just like all four gospels end, this sort of reversal of all things in suffering, in death, that there's not a final word there. And ultimately, those things can even be glory. The devil may throw you in prison, and Satan may be working against you, but even if you die, you will be a victor, receiving the crown of life. I love this summer at the church conference we got to go to, a pastor out of Nashville, Ray Ortland, was talking about sort of the way ultimately Jesus provides this tremendous victory in this moment where Satan thinks he's winning and he ultimately loses. And Ray Ortland says, the devil is such a loser. He says, I almost feel bad for him because the devil is such a loser. And I think what the letter, what John is pointing out here for his people is saying, look, even in death, there's a crown of life. There's victory in those things because there's resurrection. Verse 8, to the angel of the church of Smyrna write, the words of the first and last who died and came to life are reminded of the beginning of this idea of resurrection. In verse 11, he who has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. So even here, there's a second death you ought to be thinking about, not just the physical death. In Revelation 20 and 21, we'll unpack the idea of the second death again. This idea that, yes, there's your physical death. At some point, your body will die, but then there's going to be a resurrection and a separating out of those who have been faithful to Christ and those who have rejected Christ. And in that, there's this ability to have a final spiritual death in that moment. And each of these letters addresses to the crowd, to the one who conquers. But specifically here, we are introduced to the fact right from the get-go that Jesus has already conquered this. The one who has died and came back to life, Jesus was victorious over death, so we now share in that. If we are in him, we are also victorious over death. If death couldn't harm him, then he won't hurt us at all. At least the second death. John 14, 19, yet a little while and the world will see me no more. This is Jesus addressing his disciples right before he's about to be crucified. But you will see me because I live, you also will live. In 1 Corinthians 15, 20, Paul writing about the resurrection throughout this chapter, he says, but in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. He's the first example that's going to be for all of us who are in him. The believers will not be hurt at all by the judgment. Our sin will be judged on the cross. And in Christ, there's no more condemnation. And I think this encouragement to these people who are suffering, who are wondering why things have not been more triumphant than they should be. Maybe there's this idea of, well, the Messiah has come back. Why are we not having more victory? Why does it seem like Rome has all the power and all the chips? Why does it seem like judgment comes at the end of a sword or the foot of a boot of those in power right now? Why does it feel like there's no victory anywhere? And John's writing to these people saying, oh, there's such a greater victory that you don't even know the fullness of. And you may die, but there's a victorious crown on the other side. And guess what? There's even a second understanding of death that is so much greater because in it you are given deliverance from. So, whatever the suffering. And this message almost becomes for something more future for us. In some ways, this can almost be thought of as culture changes, as things may get worse for the church, whatever it may be, that we can hear these words and take them to heart. This call to faithfulness in the midst of suffering, particularly for our faith. A temptation to compromise, a real testing of the faith, but the promise that suffering is not the final word because Christ got up out of the grave. He's the first, the last. There's those that can kill the body, but he ultimately is the one who controls the spirit. And he rewards those who endure suffering for his name's sake. And hear me, only God knows the trials you're suffering today. I don't know what they may be. But we've heard this preached over and over again, and we've referred to passages. We just walked through James, which talks about this plenty. But what happens when that trial actually comes? And I know what happens in my life. Sometimes I just forget these things. Sometimes I forget, and we need to be reminded. And may God help us take these things, these passages, these truths, and build them into every fiber of our being so that when compromise is on the table for us and a test of our faithfulness, we may go, you know what? It is so much sweeter to be obedient. And there's such a greater reward than giving in to any temptation to bow the knee to anything else but Jesus himself. Not consumerism, not busyness and the chaos of the pace that everyone's running at, not to the changing whims of sexuality, not to all of the things that are demanding our allegiance right now, that we would go, no, Jesus, you're it. And I would be faithful to you. Let me pray for us. God, I am thankful for just the power of each of these letters. And what it would have meant for these people who are so desperately suffering in ways that we don't understand or even struggle to relate to, for them to hear these words, that they are to endure, even if it means death, that all those things are simply the schemes of the devil, that peeling back the curtain on Rome, on this collection of Jews in the city, whatever it may be, it is just our spiritual enemy trying to work against our faithfulness. So God, help us. Help us endure. Help us to see the world with a deeper spiritual vision of the way the enemy works, of the way that we are engaged, not against flesh and blood, but in principalities and powers and rulers and in a spiritual world. So God, we do that best by seeking you, praying to you, seeking your word, being connected to a body of believers that is pursuing you together, so that we can fight the good fight, finish the race, wherever that finish line is going to be. I pray all this in your name. Amen. Thanks, y'all.